This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
The claim of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that it's the church and kingdom of God restored to the earth, hinges on the validity of Joseph Smith's first vision. No vision, no church.
Coming up next, Joseph Smith's first vision.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
Tonight, we begin a series about Joseph Smith's first vision, the background, the setting, and more importantly, its significance to the whole of the Mormon story. Now, just as Joseph Smith has so many things revealed to him, line upon line, precept upon precept, so too has the singular position of the first vision and the unfolding of Mormon history and theology taken time and understanding to develop. Today, the veracity of Mormonism stands or falls with the validity of the first vision.
President Hinckley made a statement. He says, "We declare without equivocation that God the Father and His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, appeared in person to the boy Joseph Smith. Our whole strength rests on the validity of that vision. It either occurred or it did not occur. If it did not, then this work is a fraud. If it did, then it is the most important and wonderful work under the heavens."
James B. Allen.
If someone should ask why the first vision, Joseph Smith's first vision, is so important to the Latter-day Saints, I think the best answer was given by President Gordon B. Hinckley. This is the pivotal thing of our story. Every claim that we make concerning divine authority, every truth that we offer concerning the validity of this work, all finds its root in the first vision of the boy prophet. Without it, we would not have anything much to say.
Dean C. Jesse.
Joseph Smith made the statement that his intent was to lay the foundation of a work that would revolutionize the world. And the first vision is the rising of the curtain on that revolution.
The first vision is just that. It's the first of many experiences that Joseph Smith had with divinity. So why then is this experience different than all the others?
Donald L. Enders.
The first vision ushered in the dispensation of the fullness of times. That religious period in Latter-day history where the fullness of the gospel, the plan of salvation in its fullness, would be offered to mankind. The first vision also, with the appearance of the Father and the Son, set on its head the old Christian doctrine and creed that God is the Spirit, one God with three manifestations, so large that he can fill the universe, so small that he can dwell in the human heart. It also set aside mortal man's spiritual identity, that he is a child of God with divine potential. Consider, the divine Father and his beloved Son condescend to leave their heavenly home, come down to the earth and appear unto mortal man, Joseph Smith. The Father introduces the Son to Joseph, having called Joseph by name. It is the Son who instructs Joseph in the principles of salvation that spring morning of 1820. All mortals who enter into this covenant of salvation and abide by it, that selfsame Son will introduce them by name to the Father, and they will be accepted into God's presence. The first vision was the most sublime and extraordinary revelation ever entrusted to man.
So why was the first vision so extraordinary? Well, because it revealed anew the way for man's salvation, which then begs the critical question, was Joseph Smith telling the truth?
Ronald O. Barney.
If he didn't have it, then there's no claim to a reliability regarding Joseph Smith's truth claims. If he did have it, if what he was reporting was a truthful experience, then it informs everything else and defines everything else associated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints thereafter. It is rooted in what we feel very comfortable in stating is a pattern of Joseph Smith being a truth teller.
It's so important that we understand this foundation event, and for that reason, people try to obtain everything they can pertaining to the vision. The accounts of the vision are very much sought after and have been studied with a fine-tooth comb.
The first vision is much more of an issue today than it ever was 100 years ago. And that is, in some measure, because of the efforts of Mormonism's detractors.
Joseph Smith's first vision has been a part of the discussion about Mormonism from the 1830s. But it has only been in the 20th century where it has been a point of departure regarding the legitimacy of Mormonism. In the 19th century, I suppose, because I don't have any hard data on this, I suppose when there were conversations about Joseph Smith's claims to revelation and divine intervention, that many people would classify it under the idea of it's a faith matter. That is, it was something that is not demonstrable one way or the other. This is what he says happened to him. But in the 20th century, something happened that kind of changed the conversation.
That something was a book written by Fawn M. Brody, first published in 1945. It was entitled No Man Knows My History. Now, in it, Brody, the niece of David O. McKay, challenged the historicity of Joseph Smith's story.
So Fawn Brody's claim that Joseph Smith's statement about having been visited by Jesus and by our Heavenly Father was of his own manufacture created a stir in the Mormon historical community. Nobody with her credentials, nobody with her genealogy had ever made such a statement in such a consumable version, because her book is, by all accounts, well written. The conversation that has been captured in correspondence illustrates the divergence of views as to what was the root of Joseph Smith's claims. Was it pathological? That is, was there something associated with disease of mind? Or was this something that was completely a fanciful manufacture, as one modern scholar has described it, who has dismissed Joseph Smith's truth claims? Was he a pious fraud? That is, did he want to do good, but had to come up with these religious ideas in order to bolster his claims and get some claim of legitimacy amongst ignorant people? Fawn Brody's claims about Joseph Smith eventually brought censure to her from the church, and she was unchurched. There were some attempts to respond to what she had to say, but they were absent the kind of historical scrutiny that she had applied to the whole milieu of Joseph Smith during his lifetime.
Then in the 1960s, Paul Chessman, doing graduate work at Brigham Young University, was given access in the church historian's office to another account of the first vision, this one written by Joseph Smith himself in 1832. It is the earliest account of the first vision and proved to be a consequential discovery because it altered the discussion of the first vision for everyone.
In it, Joseph Smith said some things about the first vision that had formerly been unknown to most Latter-day Saints. It was his earliest attempt to describe his heavenly experiences, and in it he had portrayed what is likely the primary motive that he went into the grove. That is, he was concerned about his personal salvation. The reason that this was of consequence at the time was because there had been a codified, an authorized version of Joseph Smith's first vision, which had survived the years from the really the 1840s when it was first published up through publication in the History of the Church, and had become the version that had been most that was most familiar to Latter-day Saints or any other individual who had expressed some interest in Mormonism. So this 1832 history coming along naturally raised some interest on the part of both Latter-day Saint scholars and non-Latter-day Saints. It appears to have provoked an inquiry into particulars about the manner in which Joseph Smith told his story. That is, prior to that time, in many ways, it was considered a matter of faith. But now in the 21st or in the 20th century, when historiography had advanced to new levels, when thinking about historical matters had graduated to inquiry about the legitimacy of what was said by way of its literary expression, the first vision came under a scrutiny that had never been applied to that time, notwithstanding what Von Brody had published in the mid-1940s.
Because of Von Brody's attack on Joseph's narrative, people began to examine the details of his story and check and verify the facts as he told them. Now, Von Brody was not the only one to challenge that story.
A man by the name of the Reverend Wesley P. Walters, a Presbyterian minister from Marissa, Illinois, weighed in on all of this by publishing an article-length discussion which challenged Joseph Smith's visionary descriptions because Walters raised the question about whether there were revivals in 1820 in Western New York, which Joseph Smith, in the standardized, authorized version of the first vision, which he said was the provocation of him going into the grove. Wesley Walters created a scenario suggesting that revivals, the camp meetings that Joseph Smith referred to, did not take place until 1823, 1824. And as a result of that, Latter-day Saint scholars began to scramble to try to explain what the circumstances were of Joseph Smith's first vision in light of the larger historical context in which it occurred. Dr. James B. Allen at Brigham Young University published in the church organ at the time, The Improvement Era, I think a very important piece on the first vision, wherein he identified eight different accounts that were created during Joseph Smith's lifetime, wherein he rehearsed what had happened to him, either on paper or verbally to individuals who then wrote it down. I think it was a very, very important piece. He created a chart the improvement era to help people get their mind around the larger scope of what he was trying to say.
Others joined in on both sides, and the dialogue went on. Now, interestingly, when all was said and done, it was the Latter-day Saints who benefited the most.
It was almost like a he said, she said kind of a circumstance that I think was actually healthy, because it helped us as Latter-day Saints to understand in a way, to be able to then describe in a way the circumstances of Joseph Smith's prophetic claims that would provide, I think, for many Latter-day Saints who would never take the trouble of doing this themselves, a basis upon which to articulate their beliefs beyond just the expression of, I have a testimony of this church. Thereafter, Latter-day Saints could say, I have a testimony of Joseph Smith's divine appointment. And there's also this corroboration of what he said by way of historical appraisal, historical scrutiny, that makes it so that those who would counter my testimony by saying the evidence just doesn't stand up to this, with something that was defendable and verifiable.
Because of all this controversy, Latter-day Saints are now better equipped to defend their history than they've ever been before. Now, it should also be understood and noted that history, how it was recorded, has changed from the 19th century to the 21st. There is much more attention to detail now than there ever was then.
Now, here we are in the 21st century, highly sophisticated, technologically based, access to vast amounts of information by which we can scrutinize really anything that happened in the past. And it has caused us to be more demanding about things that happened in the past. Back then, in the 19th century, people were much more compatible with generalizations. I've gone through the accounts that Joseph Smith made of his pre-1830 experiences with the divine. These would include the first vision. These would include his statements about visitations from Moroni. These would include both the lesser and higher Melchizedek priesthood restoration narratives. Often, we find within them statements such as, meanwhile, about this time, generalizations about time periods, clearly suggesting that Joseph Smith was not very interested at all in crafting a chronology that was based upon precise dates. Let us not forget that applying the very careful way in which we scrutinize history today, that is, attention to detail, precision, we don't give much leeway for that. If we apply that same scrutiny to the way that 19th century people considered the construction of history, we're going to distort it, and we're going to diminish them intellectually because they did not measure up to the standards that we apply today. It's also the case that given what we know about Joseph Smith regarding his sermons, the other kinds of things that he did, he was much less literary than we would like him to be. He was more of a verbal prophet.
Now, while the story of the first vision became a foundational tenet of Latter-day Saint faith, belonging to everyone, to Joseph Smith, that experience was a personal pearl of great price, and he treated it as such.
In Joseph's life, few members of the church, few Latter-day Saints, even knew that he had experienced a vision And it wasn't really until the publication in serial form in the Times and Seasons at Nauvoo in 1842 that many members even became aware of the first vision. And the question may be asked, why? Joseph was a person who kept sacred things close to his heart. He didn't speak a great deal about them. Even his mother alludes to that perspective in his life. Also, the first vision was a very personal experience to him. It was his own Christian experience. And he didn't speak much of it. Now, we have a perspective that Joseph went right home from the woodlands following the vision and told his mother. Let's look at the data and kind of think about that for a moment. He went home, and as is stated in the 1838-39 account, and his mother asked him if he was all right, sensing that that he was ill or something. And he said, "Mother, I'm well enough off. I've learned for myself that Presbyterianism is not true." When he said, "Never mind, Mother," that basically was saying, "Mother, I'm not going to tell you I feel like I do." So how does this set with the historical record? I think, first of all, we must realize that Joseph, as a teenager, was persecuted. Anyone who speaks against a young person like that emotionally drains and rebukes them to the point where they are persecuted and they feel unaccepted. And certainly there was difficulties and troubles galore in 1827 when Joseph obtains the plates and persecution comes to the family. But prior to 1827 and Joseph's reception of the ancient record, Joseph and Lucy, his parents and his siblings, seem not to be as affected as is Joseph. In fact, William, his younger brother, says that we didn't know we were bad people until after Joseph received the plates. In the 1832 account, his own personal handwritten account, where he's expressing his emotions, his feelings, his remembrance of this marvelous vision, that he says that there was none who believed the heavenly vision and that he was hurt deeply by that. Now, he didn't put a disclaimer on it and say, "Well, everyone except my family, but my family did believe." No, it wasn't the case. He said, "None believed the heavenly vision." It's insightful that had the family really known of the first vision, then why did Lucy, Hiram, Sophronia, and Samuel all join the Presbyterian Church in probably 1824, slightly after Alvin's passing? And why did they remain active in the Presbyterian Church, clear up probably until September of 1828, a year after Joseph obtained the plates?
As further evidence that Joseph Smith either did not or dared not tell his family about his first vision in 1820, consider what happened the morning of September 22nd, 1823.
When the angel Moroni appeared and instructed him, he was commanded to tell his father of the vision. And the next day, when Moroni appeared unto him again in the apple orchard and said, "Did you tell your father as commanded?" Joseph said, "No." And Moroni asked, "Why did you not?" And he said, "I was afraid my father would not believe me." Now, you mean he could believe in an appearance like the first vision, God and Christ, and yet he couldn't accept the visitation of an angel? We must give this family time for things to unfold. The time would come, of course, when they would become devoted converts to the kingdom, as Joseph was able to share things with them as he felt compelled to do so. It's a good possibility that as much love as there was in the home, that there was a rejection when Joseph tried to tell them. What did he say to them? That I had a vision? That God appeared to me? How distinct was he in identifying precisely the aspects of his experience. We do not know. But the family in which he lived was a wonderful family, deeply religious people, but divergent in their perspectives.
I think he finally got to the point that he recognized that this was just too sacred an experience to be put out for more criticism, or at least for the time being. So he waited for a number of years before he actually prepared an account of the first vision that he hoped to be published to the world.
Milton V. Backman.
Now, he needed to tell others about Moroni because of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. And when early histories of the church were written, there was reference to Moroni, but there's very few references to the first vision. And again, it was so sacred that I believe Joseph Smith did not advertise it. He seldom, I believe, told others about it. And then he might have told them, no, this is very sacred, very personable, don't advertise it. And so subsequently, missionaries, as far as we know, were not going forth and telling others about the restoration and talking about the first vision.
Joseph Smith could keep sacred secrets. That we have established. But what does the abundant historical record say about him telling the truth when he did tell?
We are very comfortably in asserting the importance of the first vision as something that really happened because of the pattern that we have found of Joseph Smith being a truth teller. He did not manufacture stories. He did not make them up to bolster his waning influence upon the church. That just simply is not true. It doesn't fit anything historically that we know about him. He was careful about what he said about his private experiences, and some things he said nothing about them, except just a hint that such a thing took place. But for something as consequential as the first vision, there is a feature of great confidence among scholars who have spent an extremely significant amount of time studying this, that Joseph Smith told the truth. There was no reason for him to be anything other than a truth teller regarding the first vision.
Many of Joseph Smith's contemporaries knew that he had been visited in some manner by deity, but the details of that story were not widely known. Eventually, though, Joseph came to feel that some elements of his story needed to be told.
It's one of the most important documents we have in the church for the reason that it's the only account of the vision that's in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And it's, for that reason, extremely valuable.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, the different accounts of the first vision. Those who wrote them, and why.
I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.